Welcome to Counter Apologetics.
Welcome to Counter Apologetics. I'm your host, Emerson Green, and today we'll be discussing arguments from consciousness. Substance dualism is the standard view among theists. They believe that the mind can't be reduced to the workings of something physical, like the brain, and that the mind and body are made of two distinct substances. There are many arguments from consciousness and a vast range of opinion among experts on the issue of consciousness. We'll be talking about the common claim of apologists that science and naturalism can't account for conscious creatures like ourselves, but that theism can, and that this amounts to an argument in favor of theism. But before we go any further, let's go over some philosophy of mind in order to get our bearings. First of all, what do we mean when we say consciousness? The best definition, in my opinion, is one that Thomas Nagel uses in his famous essay, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? He says, quote, "The fact that an organism has conscious experience at all means, basically, that there is something that it is like to be that organism. Fundamentally, an organism has conscious mental states if and only if there is something that it is like to be that organism. We may call this the subjective character of experience." End quote. So, for something to be conscious means that it is like something to be that thing. It's not like something to be a rock or to be a cork. But it is like something to be a human, or a bat, or a dog. Many of the details of a subjective experience could be different from our own, but the point is that it is like something to be a conscious system. So that's what we mean when we say that something is conscious. The hard problem of consciousness is highly relevant to these sorts of discussions, so let me briefly lay out what's called the hard problem. It starts with a not-so-shocking observation. The world is made of atoms. Atoms, which are made of subatomic particles, which are excitations of quantum fields. But the point is that there is only unfeeling, non-conscious matter on the most fundamental levels of our universe. You're able to follow the plot that science has pieced together from the most fundamental levels of the universe to the most emergent levels, from physics to chemistry to microbiology and so on. But at some point, some of this matter becomes conscious. We go from the fundamental levels, which are made up of non-conscious, physical material that has no subjective experience, and at some point, we get conscious physical material that has a subjective experience. The phrase, the hard problem of consciousness, was coined by the philosopher of mind David Chalmers. The hard problem is something that's discussed in secular philosophy of mind, entirely separate from any discussion of religion. So this doesn't just pertain to theism versus naturalism. To quote the neuroscientist Anil Seth, "For many people, the phenomenon of consciousness is the best evidence we have that there must be something important missing in our basic physical description of the world. According to this worry, a bunch of atoms and particles, mindlessly obeying the laws of physics, can't actually experience the way a conscious creature does. There's no such thing as what it is like to be a collection of purely physical atoms. It would lack qualia, the irreducibly subjective components of our experience of the world." End quote. Many neuroscientists and philosophers of mind, including the one I just quoted, Anil Seth, don't actually think that the hard problem is as intractable as it may sound at first blush. And even the ones who do think the hard problem is a serious issue are not always sympathetic to theistic explanations or substance dualism. David Chalmers, the philosopher who coined the phrase, is not a substance dualist. He just believes, as Anil Seth mentioned, that there is something missing from our basic physical description of the world, but he's still a naturalist. Sam Harris also believes the hard problem is a real issue, and he's definitely not sympathetic to theism. One response to the hard problem is to point out that it may be a compositional fallacy. Apologists and others will try to argue that inanimate material will never suddenly gain qualia. Atoms aren't conscious, so it's not as if you can just arrange a bunch of atoms a certain way and get consciousness, they would argue. But the higher-level emergent properties of something don't have to be present in the lower-level constituents of that thing. A single atom can't be described as red, but that doesn't mean that a collection of atoms can't have the property of redness. By the way, it's called the hard problem of consciousness to distinguish itself from the easy problems. The difference between being awake and asleep, how we collect data from the outside world and store information, how we remember the past, and so on. Many neuroscientists think that once we've solved all the easy problems, there won't be any hard problem left to solve. But many think there will still be a question as to why we're conscious once we've solved all the easy problems. Those who take this position often make their case by asking us to try to conceive of hypothetical beings called philosophical zombies. Philosophical zombies are just like us, but it isn't like anything to be them. They do all the things we do, but they have no inner subjective life. If we can conceive of a being that's just like us in every way but isn't conscious, then the hard problem seems to persist. But are philosophical zombies actually so easy to imagine?
I mean, the hard problem has its conceptual power over us because it asks us to imagine systems, philosophical zombies, that are completely equivalent in terms of their function and behavior to you or to me or to any or to a conscious bat, but that instantiate no phenomenal properties at all. The lights are completely off for these philosophical zombies. And if we can imagine such a system, if we can imagine such a thing, a philosophical zombie, you or me, then it does become this enormous challenge. You think, well, then what is it or what could it be that gives rise, that requires or entails that there are also these phenomenal properties, that there is something it is like to be you or me or the bat? Chalmers would argue that such things are conceivable, that the hard problem seems like a really huge problem. And the more you know about a system, you know, the more we know about the easy problem, the less convincing it is to imagine a zombie alternative. You're a kid, you look up at the sky and you see a 747 flying overhead, and somebody asks you to imagine a 747 flying backwards. Well, you can imagine a 747 flying backwards. But the more you learn about aerodynamics, about engineering, the harder it is to conceive of a 747 flying backwards. You know, you simply can't build one that way. And that's my worry about this kind of conceivability argument, that to me, I really don't think I can imagine in a serious way the existence of a philosophical zombie. And if I can't imagine a zombie, then the hard problem loses some of its force.
Once we solve the easy problems, there may no longer be a hard problem. If philosophical zombies aren't conceivable once you actually learn more about the easy problems, then the hard problem is just a non-problem. We can draw an analogy here to life. Many neuroscientists have pointed out that the situation we're currently in feels a lot like the state of affairs biologists and philosophers were in before we gained our current understanding of microbiology. People thought life could never be explained in materialistic, naturalistic terms. There were many subscribers to an idea called vitalism, where a life force, or élan vital, was postulated to explain the difference between living things and dead things. You could almost think of it as the hard problem of life. Living systems have all these interesting, unique properties. They can metabolize, they can make copies of themselves, they can repair themselves from injury. People thought there would never be a mechanistic explanation for these things. And that's why they thought we needed élan vital, a non-physical substance or force, to make sense of the fact that life is so different from non-life. This obviously didn't turn out to be the case. Once they learned more about the mechanistic workings of life, there wasn't any need for élan vital. An extremely common argument for why we have an immaterial soul is because the Bible says we do.
For 2,000 years, the church has understood the Bible to teach that there's a soul. This is what Jesus appears to have taught. It's what Paul appears to have taught. Now, this teaching implies that there's more to us than our brains and our bodies, that we are, in fact, souls that have bodies.
I believe in such a thing primarily because that's what's taught in the Bible. And I think that, as I said before, I have good reasons to think that what Jesus said and did were correct, and that, therefore, when the Bible teaches that we have a soul in addition to the body, that it's right.
The Bible also says that pi is equal to 3 and that stars can fall out of the sky and land on the earth. This point is probably just to convince people who already treat the Bible as an authority, but it came up in every argument from consciousness apologetics resource that I found, so I thought I should mention it anyway. But what are the actual philosophical arguments that apologists use to defend the concept of the soul?
To present this argument in its syllogistic form, it is a fact that human consciousness exists. This fact can be adequately explained within a theistic framework. i.e. one which posits God's existence, whereas it cannot be adequately explained within a naturalistic or materialistic framework. Hence, there is a fact that only theism can adequately explain. Therefore, God exists.
First off, it needs to be pointed out that the argument from consciousness is basically a God of the gaps argument. We don't know how to explain consciousness, therefore God. Here's something on the frontiers of science that we don't fully understand, and of course, that's the thing that God did. So I've made this point before, but the list of things we used to not understand physically and attributed to the supernatural is virtually endless. Disease, failed crops, thunderstorms, the diversity and complexity of life, and on the list goes. If we lived a few hundred years ago, theists would have been appealing to earthquakes and trees as arguments for the existence of God. It's an accident of history that we're alive now, talking about the details of how the brain produces consciousness instead. Neuroscience is confusing, therefore God is not a good argument. And we'll talk in more detail about whether or not consciousness can be understood in a naturalistic framework in the next podcast, but first let's talk about why Christians think consciousness makes more sense on a theistic worldview, besides the fact that they just get to invoke magic. One of the points believers make is based on the persistence of identity through physical change. They say that the physical parts of you, like the cells of your body, are replaced over and over again, and yet your core identity remains. They're arguing that there must be something non-physical or something immaterial about you, since basic information about you persists, though your brain cells are constantly being replaced. This is wrong, since the information that makes you, you, the arrangement and configuration of the brain, isn't going anywhere. Fingerprints are a good analogy. The specific pattern that makes up your fingerprint doesn't change even though the skin cells are constantly being replaced. Does this mean that fingerprints are made of some immaterial substance? And the fact is that no matter what you believe, personal identity is not so simple. Whatever the implications may be, the fact is that you do change drastically as time goes on, even if your former selves and future selves have some things in common. But there's no need to postulate an immaterial self to explain these things in common, any more than we need to postulate an immaterial fingerprint to explain that part of you remaining constant. Many objections to a more scientific view of consciousness are ultimately based on appeals to introspection. If you introspect and think about your own experience as a conscious creature, you don't immediately apprehend any physical workings. You don't introspect and sense neurons firing. Instead, you observe emotions, feelings, thoughts, and desires. Apologists try to argue that introspection and what we apprehend through it should count as some evidence that our mind is more than the physical workings of our brain. But of course, there's no reason to think that our introspection would reveal reality as it really was. We know the process by which our intuitions evolved, and we have to recognize what their function is and that they're only reliable within their domain. Any argument about the fundamental nature of consciousness that merely appeals to our intuition doesn't qualify as a compelling argument. And this goes back to the hard problem. Our intuition would say that it's possible for philosophical zombies to exist. At first, it seems like we can imagine humans that are physically identical to us, but have no inner conscious experience. But as many neuroscientists have pointed out, once you learn the relevant science, it gets harder and harder to conceive of humans that are atom-for-atom copies of ourselves, but have no inner mental experience. 25 years after Joseph Priestley discovered the element of oxygen, it was discovered that water is made of two parts hydrogen and one part oxygen. If you were to ask Joseph Priestley prior to then if he could imagine water without oxygen, presumably he would have had no problem conceiving of it. But now, with our current knowledge of water and its physical properties, we know that water without oxygen is not conceivable. The various thought experiments that demonstrate the hard problem do a good job of pinpointing our intuition about why consciousness can't be purely physical, but the past has shown us that an argument that just appeals to our intuition isn't good enough. Besides appealing to introspection and identity, apologists also invoke something called intentionality to support their case.
Philosophers are puzzled by states of intentionality. Intentionality is the property of being about something or of something. It signifies the object-directedness of our thoughts. For example, I can think about my summer vacation, or I can think of my wife. No physical object has this sort of intentionality. A chair or a stone or a glob of tissue like the brain is not about or of something else. Only mental states or states of consciousness are about other things.
I think a clearer way of saying this is that purely physical objects can't contain representational information. But anyone listening to this podcast knows this is incorrect. You're listening to an audio file that contains representational information about consciousness. There's nothing immaterial in that audio file or on the server where it's stored. In the same way there can be a video on YouTube of a cat or about divine hiddenness, our brains can have thoughts of a cat or about divine hiddenness. Physical devices like microphones and cameras collect and playback data that can be entirely described in physical, material terms. Likewise, our sense organs collect physical data and store it in our brains, and you can play back this representational information given certain physical events preceding the playback. The arrangement of atoms in your hippocampus, for example, can literally be said to be of or about something, just as the physical arrangement of atoms in a computer can be of or about something without containing an immaterial soul. Intentionality is something that secular philosophers of mind discuss, though there's a range of opinion regarding it as a concept. As far as I can tell, nothing is added to our understanding of consciousness by speaking in terms of ofness and aboutness, but either way, it's certainly not an argument for an immaterial soul. Something I never understood is why God would make the material world at all. If you're God, there's just no reason to create physical matter. If God is immaterial and what we really are is a soul, then what's the point? If God doesn't need matter and we don't need matter for our minds to exist, what exactly is matter contributing? On the account of Christian substance dualists, the material world is entirely superfluous. Something related to keep in mind is that the argument from consciousness, in most of its forms, is incompatible with the fine-tuning argument. This is because the fine-tuning argument assumes that we could only be here if the physical parameters of the universe hold very specific values. But the only framework where the emergence of consciousness is dependent on what matter does is materialism. If consciousness is entirely independent from the physical world, it doesn't matter what the physical world is doing. Your soul would still be here regardless of how the laws of nature were tuned. But if you're a Christian substance dualist, there's no reason to fine-tune anything. There's no reason the physical world would exist at all, but there's also no reason the physical, material parameters of nature would need to hold certain values for our non-physical, immaterial souls to exist. That's all I have for you today. I have some new patrons to thank: Al from Cestus III, who upped his pledge, and Evan Davids. Thank you, Al, and thank you, Evan. Evan is a longtime listener, so I thought I would mention that he has published a book called Christianity No Longer Makes Sense, and that's linked in the show notes if you're interested. And of course, thanks to my Hall of Fame patrons, Peach Machine and Jesta. And you can support this show on a per-episode basis at patreon.com/counter, where you can earn early access to every episode and access to bonus episodes. If you don't have the money to support on Patreon, but you still want to be an unwitting tool of Satan, you can like us on our social media, leave a 5-star review, or tell your friends about the podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by the band Wailers. The song is called Magic Tricks and was used with permission. Thank you for joining me today. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.